Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, Maxine Hong Kingston. Maxine Hong Kingston's debut book, The Woman Warrior, Memoirs of a Girlhood Among Ghosts, gained her worldwide attention and won the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1976. Her next book, Chinamen, won the 1981 American Book Award. Kingston has said she considers these books two halves of a whole. At the time of her lecture, Kingston was working on an autobiographical piece that detailed the burning of her home and the loss of her latest book to the fire, which took place only a short time before her visit to Portland. This work would be later titled The Fifth Book of Peace in homage to the books of peace that appeared in China hundreds of years ago that were deliberately burned because of how threatening they were to the reigning powers. In The Fifth Book of Peace, Kingston narrates her attempts to rebuild her life and her writing after the fire. Kingston is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, the National Humanities Medal, the John Dossos Prize for Literature, and the National Medal of Arts. Her works of fiction include Tripmaster Monkey and Hawaii One Summer. Now, from the 1991-92 season of Portland Arts and Lectures, here is Maxine Hong Kingston speaking in front of a live audience at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall.
Good evening. Thank you for the kind welcome. Tonight I want to tell you about the book that was burned in the fire. I had not named it yet. I didn't have a title, but there was a subtitle, and the subtitle was A Book of Peace. And it was my idea to write a book in the tradition of three Chinese books of peace. Mythically, we hear that at various times in the thousands of years of Chinese history, there were books of peace that told tactics for how to negotiate conflict, how to avoid war, how to build a peaceful society. And as each one of these were written, I think. I don't think any of them lasted for very long. They were destroyed. Sometimes a library would burn, and the book would be destroyed. And then another one was written, and there would be one of a change of regime. And you know, when a new king or emperor came in, he would order the books burned and the historians killed. And then, of course, I suppose there were also natural firestorms too. But what we know of those books is just about what I've told you. That in a way. We don't know that they ever really existed, except in dreams of people who thought about whether peace was a possibility. And so, so it was my idea that I would see whether I could reconstitute one of these books of peace by envisioning what might have been in them, and then writing one for our times. I was experimenting with what kind of a form a peace book might take, and I see that the plots, the way that books and plays and movies and television, they seem to all have the same kind of pattern, which must be a pattern that's in the human mind and psyche, which is that there is a rising action and then a violent confrontation and climax, and then and through that is a realization and revelation. And so I was thinking, is it possible to give a different shape to the novel? And so that when when it, this new shape of story, if it could be written and if there were readers, it could change the patterns in our minds so that work for toward a non-violent resolutions and climaxes. Is it possible to have drama without violence? So I was I was trying for a new kind of plot, and then this story would be populated by new kinds of characters. I was inventing characters that who had peaceful souls, so that when they came across our human problems, they could deal with them in peaceful ways. And I was writing about a marriage in which the people, it wasn't just a young marriage, but they could go into middle age and treat one another in a loving ways. And while writing this story and these characters, of course, I was working on inventing a nonviolent language, and so that language itself becomes peaceful, and the metaphors would be peaceful. I would get rid of all those metaphors about how we, shoot for goals and how you know all those metaphors. So actually, when this book burned in the fire, it felt very cosmic in a way, because then my book became one of the books that burned, and it's also a book of peace. I mean, it's just so strange. It made me feel as if there are forces of destruction and forces of creation out there, and the forces of destruction burned one peace book after another, and it got mine too. During these last 2 months, as I try to figure out what to do next, and how to write again, and what methods I could use to write another book of peace. It would be, I guess, if you count the three that were lost in China and you count the one that I just lost in Oakland, I would be starting the fifth book of peace. Now, what methods can I use? One of the things I did I had a student who was an English major and then became a hypnotherapist in the last few years. And so I asked him to come over and hypnotize me, and maybe I could recall the book. The original plan, he said, okay, I'll hypnotize you, and you can envision the screen of the television set of the terminal, and then as your words come up, you read them, and then we'll tape you onto this tape recorder. And I really thought, I mean, this plan scared me because I was thinking, it seems so static or rigid. The process was just recalling. It's just a memorization trick. And what if all I could do was remember, and then I would be frozen into that version and not be able to rewrite and change things. Because it scared me also because memorization is not interesting to me. As I write, I like to be constantly discovering, going into the unknown territories, making the map as I go along, and every word that comes next is a discovery. And this would be boring to just try to remember what came before. But then so I talked to him about that, and then we came up with another method, which was that I would set off on this journey, and I would arrive at my house after finding many, guides and companions and helpers. Then I would get to my house and envision it whole and go inside the alcove where I was working, and there would be my pages and the computer with this light and water that I had found in this psychic journey. And it was a flask of light and water. I am sure this is the same flask that Psyche found in her woman's journey, that Aphrodite sent her on this quest, and she found this flask of water that the eagle helped her find. Except for me, I found a spotted owl. See, this that my guiding bird is a spotted owl, and then I had this water, and I covered the room and my manuscripts and that computer with it, and it made this golden light, and the spotted owl is sitting in the redwood tree, then all my characters came, the people that I had invented, all these peaceful, good people came, the post-hypnotic suggestion is that any time I needed them or that I needed my pages, I could hypnotize myself and go back and find a page and retrieve what I needed for this next version. And also my characters could talk to me and tell me how to write. Okay, so that's one new method that has come to me as I try to find this book again. Another thing that happened, I lost everything, all my material possessions, and for a moment I did enjoy owning nothing, but suddenly, you know, almost right away, in this material society, you can't have nothing for very long, because everyone insists on giving you gifts and clothes and underwear and everything, and people started calling me with the most wonderful word gifts. A friend of mine told me a story about Josephine Miles. The last time that Berkeley burned, I guess it was in the 70s, Josephine Miles said that everybody in town said that they had lost a manuscript in the fire. But then she said that 5 years later, the best writing, the best poetry was being published out of Berkeley. And one of the reasons must be that all these people were bragging about what they had done, and so they had to live up to it. Another reason could be that that everything had been destroyed, and so they were more determined than ever to retrieve something out of that destruction, and so the forces of creativity were even stronger. And I think another reason maybe was that the fire burned all their half-baked ideas and got rid of that, or they finished cooking them, And there's just the essence that was left. And essence is what poetry is. Another friend called. She's Phyllis Hogue Thompson. She's a great Quaker poet. And she said, I just have to say this to you. She said, if a woman is going to write a book of peace, it's given her to know total devastation. And I thought, wow, that's great. And so I got off the phone right away and I wrote it down. And then I decided that that will be the sentence. That will be the first sentence of the new book that I'm going to write. Okay, so since the fire, I have written 18 pages. And so now I know what my rate is. It's like 9 pages a month is the way it's going right now. I'm going to read to you tonight the 18 pages that I've been working on since the fire. If a woman is going to write a book of peace, it is given her to know devastation. Oh, notice that I rewrote her sentence. She said total devastation. And I left out the total because I don't think it's total. I mean, there's a lot left. If a woman is going to write a book of peace, it is given her to know devastation. I have lost my book, 156 good pages, in a firestorm that blew out of the Oakland Berkeley Hills and took my house, things, neighborhood, and other neighborhoods and forests. I almost reached my manuscript in time. I was driving back home from funeral rituals for my father. I have lost my father. He's gone less than a month. We were having one-month rituals early, Sunday, day off. It was the first time in my life I'd driven alone by myself away from Stockton and my parents' house. I turned on public radio for the intelligent voices and heard that the hills were burning quite a long way off. 45 houses destroyed toward Moraga, toward Walnut Creek. I could not understand directions, which way was east, west of the Caldecott Tunnel, north, south of the Warren Freeway. I pictured the fire far up in the hills, impossible that it crossed the freeway. Behind me, my sister-in-law Cindy was chasing me at 90 miles per hour. The family, not my mother, from whom we're trying to hide dangers, sent her to get me to turn back. She ran out of gas at Tracy. By the time I was going over the Altamont Pass, the windmills on the acres of wind farms were turning as usual. The Claremont Hotel was not on fire, but 150 houses burning and the fire not contained. The fire had blown to our side of the 10-lane freeway over and through Highway 24 and Highway 13. The newscaster said no cars have been trapped in the Caldecott Tunnel as originally feared. A police car and flares blocked the exit to my street. I drove fast to the next exit, which was also blocked. I had a sense that the police were setting up the roadblocks moments ahead of me. If I had driven faster, I might have saved the manuscript and my mother's jewelry and my father's watch, his eyeglasses, which fit my eyes, and his draft card, which I had found in his wallet. This card is to be carried on your person at all times. He carried it for, 60 years. I got off onto West MacArthur Boulevard and drove too slowly through complicated traffic. It was the middle of the afternoon, about 2:30. The sky was black, the sun was red. This was a forest fire, and ashes were falling in downtown Oakland. Sheets of black paper flew among the tall buildings. I stopped at a store to ask whether I was going the right direction after driving a long while without coming to landmarks. I parked, could find no coin to put in the meter, and stood in line behind many, many after-school kids buying candy. Oh, I now realize it was Sunday, so they weren't after-school kids. Well, that'll be in the next draft, okay? This is just the first draft, okay? I kept staying the last person in a shrinking, growing line. I went outside, too many cars to jaywalk to a security patrol office, and went back inside the store. The kids were thinking over the candies to the sides of the cash register. I told the clerk that I was lost because I couldn't get off at my exit because of the fire. Which way to Berkeley? I cared that he'd think I didn't belong to and didn't know that neighborhood. Though he was a foreigner, and the woman sitting almost hidden behind the counter, also a foreigner. She wore a white scarf that covered her hair and a long skirt with an apron, as if she were cooking. She was not an old woman, nor from olden days, but from an old country. I couldn't tell their country, not Mexico or South America or the Philippines, from the man's accent. The woman didn't try to help me out, didn't say anything or give me a kind look. I get scared whenever I dearly want to learn something, that I'm not going to be given the knowledge, that I'm not going to get it, that I'll forget it. I did not tell exactly where I was heading in case he wanted to cooperate with the roadblocks. He put me back on the freeway. I got off onto Broadway and kept going in what seemed to me the continuing direction until I saw a waterfront and the bay. Broadway then goes all the way across Oakland from the bay to my house. In the middle of my U-turn, the radio said that Broadway and Broadway Terrace were on fire and that there was looting on Ostrander Street. I pictured those two parallel streets, Broadway for the cars, Broadway Terrace for walking, eucalyptus and pine trees and apple trees between them and along them, a tree-high wall, 2 feet thick of flame. Making the U-turn, I said out loud, no, no, no. Ostrander was a small street very nearby on a hill curving down to my house. Families of quails would come walking out of and running into the bushes. Once I had stood amazed at the center of a storm of birds, robins, blue jays, chickadees. What's wonderful about Oakland? You'll see a white crane extending itself, flying over the city. It must live at Lake Merritt or Lake Anza or Temescal. Anne Frank saw cranes out the sky window. It can't be too late. All I want is a minute inside the house. Run to the far end of the living room where my manuscript is in a wine box in the alcove. And with one more breath, run upstairs for the gold and jade that my ancestresses had been able to keep safe through the wars in China and the journeying across continents and oceans. It's just amazing how all images come together. You know, jade is a peace jade. It's a stone of peace. And you wear it for peace of mind and also for your aspirations, I guess, for the world. Stupid about directions, I lost time. At where Berkeley forks the California College of Arts and Crafts, where Whitman kissed Tanya, but a few feet from the sign pointing up to Broadway Terrace, the police were herding the cars down and away to College Avenue. I stopped at the light and got out to try to talk a policeman into letting me through. Even though the light turned green, the people behind me didn't honk or yell. I asked, "Are you sure I can't drive up there?" He said that no cars were allowed past that point. I did not ask, "May I go to my house on foot then?" I drove diagonally across the intersection and parked in the red curb stop for the College Avenue bus. The police wouldn't be writing parking tickets today, or $28 worth it. The car could have been left there by someone who had escaped the fire and was staying as close as he could to home. I stood at the corner plotting how I was going to get past the police and got in step with an African-American family with many children crossing the street. I told them I lived on Golden Gate Avenue and was trying to get there. Where did they live? They lived on Brookside, which winds around Golden Gate. I asked, "Were you officially evacuated? Has our area been officially evacuated yet?" They didn't know, but they had been back to their house. The father said, "The police will escort you up to your house if you tell them it's a life and death situation." The mother said, "They drove us up there." I said, "What was the life and death situation you told them?" "We couldn't find our son. Our son was missing." The kids, all about junior high age, were smiling and safe. I couldn't tell which one was the one lost and now found. An unfinished book is nothing as important as a child. I told the family I was trying to save the manuscript of a book I was writing. Said out loud in the open air to actual people who did not get excited, my plight did not seem to have enormity. I've been working on it for years, I said. About 1.5 years. Is 1.5 years much? It depends on which years. Didn't Rilke write the Duino elegies in 6 months? Or was it 6 hours, one wide awake night? The happy family and I wished one another good luck and take care. While the policemen, the Oakland cops aren't as big as during the free speech movement.
You're listening to Maxine Hong Kingston speaking in Portland in 1992. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project, and there's more from Kingston coming up. This is Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This time, it's Maxine Hong Kingston. Let's return to her talk in Portland in 1992.
I walked through the barricades up into the defined fire area. Householders were still there, hosing down their roofs and dry grass. A flare of fire fell out of the sky and landed behind a man watering his property. I motioned to him that he look to his rear, but he stared at me as if I were a crazy woman. I ran on. That flame had gone out. Others that were raining on his roof, his spray couldn't reach anyway. Oh, I see that. See, the reason that he couldn't hear me and I had to motion to him was that the helicopters were everywhere and making their noise. And I'll put that in the second draft also. But you see how all the images are fitting together because that was an important image of the Vietnam War too, was the helicopters. And so here's the helicopters at the fire. So that will fit in as this heads toward being a book about peace. I was most scared when there were no people in sight. I had to be very careful and mindful of the air in which poison oak was burning, but I was not having trouble breathing. I ran slow enough so that I might control my wind. In case a gust of bad air surrounded me, I would not have to gulp it. I held my hair as a filter over my nose and mouth and breathed through it quite naturally. I passed many side streets without deciding to turn left into one. Many of these streets ended in cul-de-sacs or curved back out. I was mad at myself for not having paid better attention which streets went through where. Who was telling me a story about a child who lived near the burning of a great library? He caught pages of burnt paper and read Latin words. At Margarito, a long, wide street, I turned further toward the heat and fire. I passed a man and a woman leaving and a homeowner watering his house. No one knew whether or not this street were officially evacuated. I arrived at the edge of the golf course. The air was thick and there were branches on fire. I imagined myself running under the eucalyptus trees, but before getting to the open field, the trees dropping fire on my head and exploding. My husband teases that I'm always afraid of things exploding. Be careful, watch out, it's going to explode. Motors, dead animals, spiders, Tulies. If I crossed the golf course, I would come out at the corner of Broadway Terrace and Ostrander amidst the fire and the looters. I turned about and considered whether I was giving up on my writing. I let the possibility that the book was gone, my book gone, enter my ken. I did not feel bad, no fear, no pain. I was not believing that I had lost the book. I had not stopped trying to rescue it. Again, I passed the men watering down their houses, though the sky was darker now and the air worse. The sun was ugly red. I was fast running back because downhill and toward safe crowds and lights and air. I drove continuing on college to Chabot Road, which was barricaded. Chabot Road was my familiar turn home. It was not right that it be an impasse. I parked, surprised at how much free parking there was. As before, I became invisible to the police and walked for home. This way seemed almost normal. I should have gone up these known streets in the first place. As always, there was a stillness at St. Albert's. The monks had either evacuated the monastery or they were staying hidden. You hardly ever see them in the garden or out on the tennis courts anyway. The atmosphere feels full of prayer. The row of beech trees, my signifying tree, stood unharmed, the first tree seen by me when a child, and more magnificent each time I have found another one. Here was a row of 9 beech trees, here before I was here, and meant to outlast me. I do not remember, however, touching them, each one, the elephant bark, the horned toad bark, as I usually do. I must have rushed past them. The leaves were a strong green, though October was ending, and my 50th year was ending. The strange shifting light, the winds were blowing the weather and the time of day crazily up and down the street, stilled at St. Albert's, and started up again at Chabot Elementary, shadows swinging across the asphalt and through the cyclone fences, backstop, and jungle gym bars. Why do we raise children on ground barren of trees and grass? We are teaching them to endure a world like a cage and jail. Not until Golden Gate Avenue did I actually see burning, and it didn't look that bad, unless you knew what had been there before. The slopes on either side of the road were cleared of ivy and dill. Farmers will weed a field by burning the cane, chafe, burdocks down to fertile ash and black earth. Golden Gate, my street, begins at a cement bridge with a sign, narrow bridge. This bridge goes under a steel bridge for the BART train. It's a wonderful surprise whenever the train appears out of or into the trees. The radio had said that BART shut off the Concord line. No information about fire damage to the train or its route. The rust-colored girders were smoking hot. I thought about whether I should go under there. The metal could melt and hit me. The entire structure break loose and drop. I needed to see around a bend to my house. I couldn't see through the train bridge to houses on the other side, but wasn't sure if you ever could from here anyway. I ran quickly straight forward and felt the heat from above. I was in a gigantic kiln, which has since recurred in my nightmares. I am flying up into the hot ceiling and can't wake up. I came out into a changed world. The ground was a tangle with fallen power lines. There were logs burning in the middle of the street. I couldn't believe that the 30 miles an hour winds I'd heard about on the radio could throw chunks of houses about like that. They must have been blown here from explosions. The college prep school was not harmed. The roof beams, bare wood outline of the gym or auditorium they were building, poked up out of the top of the canyon, which contains just the school. I'd been unhappy that they would most likely not cover this big new building with brown shingles to match the rest of the school and the environment. If you did not want the cutting of a dozen or so trees, the posters that had been stapled to them had declared you should petition the city and county or forever hold your peace. The shape of the canyon stood out, a black and defoliated wedge. It confused me not to see the houses and the trees that I was looking for. My memory was off, or they had burned away. A thing would appear, but it would be out of the order that was in my mind, and it did not cue a next thing to appear. I am not enough awake. One more bend and my house should come into sight. The unwanted little house on the corner that has changed owners yearly was still alive. The white boards of the edge furthest from my house seemed water-soaked. A fireman was puttering about a medium-sized yellow fire truck parked across from the saved little house and next to the stone retaining wall. From here, like outside a walled city, I cannot see above the balustrade to the hill houses. The fireman said, "We didn't get water up here." A mess of flat hoses and downed phone wires lay like white serpents and black serpents all over the streets and sidewalks. I would not have gone on but for the fireman and a man who had gotten off his bicycle and was pushing it alongside me. There were no other people about. The house in the gully made it, crouching under the flames. The fire had blown over the top of the land. Stepping carefully over each wire, turning the bend, I looked up and saw that my house was gone. It was not that I recognized the place it had stood or any familiar piece of it or its neighbors, but that the landscape was everywhere utterly changed. I had come to the ash moon of a planet that passes through the sun. A house, not any I had seen before from this angle. I was looking at it through rows of invisible gone houses, was entire inside of a flame. The flame was a clear, shimmering, tapering orange jewel that held the house whole, the crystal inside a crystal, beautiful, perfect translucence. I had expected burning to be many flames, eating away a thing, blackening it, then it falling apart section by section. On the other side of the street, there was a flagpole, so high that the flag was only singed, as I remember it, and limp because the winds that I had heard about on the radio had stopped. So though I could not identify it exactly, I did lay eyes on the site of my house across the street from the flag. Later, the ruins of our neighborhood kept appearing on the news because of that flag, clean and new in the pictures, and upon my seeing it again. I might have imagined it scorched, or my neighbors had run up a new Stars and Stripes. My flag, a white dove on a sky blue field, was gone. I had sewn two of them during Desert Storm and hung one out the upstairs front window and the other out the side toward the peaceful neighbor to hearten her. She had been the first to put up a peace sign made on her home computer. Across the top of the picture window, it said, "Every soldier is somebody's son," and across the bottom, "or daughter." A few days a week later, for the remaining days of our country's mad fit, she changed to a hand-painted sign, "War is not an energy policy." We were two households with such ideas amidst the trees and phone poles and gates tied with yellow ribbons. Even the gigantic eucalyptus at our crossroads had been tied. Some middle of the night it was untied, not by me, and never retied. Nobody threw rocks through anybody else's windows. The writing was gone, and my father was gone, fatherless and thingless. Suddenly I felt rushing at me, like a movie of a fire run backwards, and smoke ghosts hurrying back into the building, refilling it, pulling it upright. I felt coming back to me, oh, but here, all along in my chest and stomach, ideas, whatever this is that fire can't burn, spirit, which I had made from working and living as I do, though often purposely or accidentally unconscious. Nonetheless, I have perceived an interesting, beautiful world caused by my ways of seeing it. I wove and sewed its meanings, invisible jewels. This strength in my chest and stomach are myself embodying values that I have thought out and acted upon. Compassion, beauty, peace are real. I was having intimations first had on LSD at the age of 21. Ideas have an invisible existence that protects them, pervious to fire and bombs. I am very good at feeling them. If the fire had killed me, do my ideas live without me breathing and thinking? My father is trying to kill me, to take me with him. We left out something in the rituals, and he's angry. This Holocaust is the size of the anger that had been his task as a human being to socialize. Now he is dead. This heat is loose. Yes, it is the same hot feeling as anger, but it surrounds and is outside the body. I have always wanted the life you have. My father started saying that to me when I became a published paid writer. I thought he was wishing to have poems come to him as they do to me, and to have readers. My mother tried scolding him into poetry. You used to be a poet. Where are the poems, poet? He wondered, why is it that I can like to read poems so much, but I can't write them? At the ritual, when each of us, his children, spread a fabric of colors and flowers over his body, blanketing him like in a fairy tale, I tucked the fountain pen that my son had given me into his breast pocket. One evening and 2 days, we sent him paper, gold, silver, and orange paper, folded like boats and strung like leis, big enough to go around the necks of horses and elephants, more paper than anybody else gets. I had begun this day, morning seems a very long time ago, by burning paper to him. We fed the paper, symbols of everything, into the brick fireplace in the Chinese cemetery on I-5. The chimney standing out there in the open seems to be hearth for the ancestors, all the skies and land of the San Joaquin Valley, at the last their home. But from the timing and directions of the rituals, you can almost see the dimensions of another further away home. Its distance from the earth is about a month's walk away. We helped our father on the climb up the mountain, which is steep and dark. He is lonely, missing his body and everybody, us. We escorted him with our thoughts and imaginations, persuading him on and on. Our every wish against his leaving made it hard on him. Today, upon the one-month ceremonies, he enters that place where all of us will disappear when we die. Our cousin-in-law from China, she is very beautiful, very Chinese, hunkered by his grave, next to his head, I think, and invited him to eat and drink, tilting up and down the cups of whiskey, the whole chicken, and the bowl of rice, picadored with 2 smoking incense sticks. She interlaced her fingers and naturally, informally, bowed her head 3 times and hands many times, and said, instructing us, "Say bye-bye to Babala." It was almost unbearable to watch my younger brothers and sisters, one by one, hands together like angels, bowing to our father and all the awful conditions of life. Especially if you are a veteran of war, I'm very interested in hearing or you're writing down a story about how you got from being a warrior to living the life of peace that you have today. What happened in the last 20 years to bring you to where you are now? I have a story that is similar to that I am working on. You know, my book, Woman Warrior, lately, as I grow stronger in peace, I have regretted that I have that title, Woman Warrior, you know, and she was a swordswoman. She solved problems with a sword. And so it's my task now to finish that story, or to correct myself in the next book. One thing that I will do is to restore the ending to the old woman warrior myth. She was a Fa Mulan, and she had led this army into battle against the Tartars, and she was disguised as a man. Okay, now I put all of that in the woman warrior. Okay, the part that I left out that I want to restore is that when she returned from battle, she brought her soldiers home with her, and she told them to wait for her. And then she went inside the house, and she took off her armor, her disguise, and she bathed, and she put on her silk robes, and she put on her makeup, and did her hair. She had, in the chant, she has beautiful, long, black hair. and she dresses it and puts flowers in it. Her name, Fa Mulan, means flower orchid. So flowers are important symbol for her. And then she walked out in front of her soldiers, and she tells them that she was the general that had been leading them all this time. And she revealed her this new self, that she was a woman. You know, what she was doing was giving them a gift before dismissing them. She let them see that when you come home from war, you don't have to return as a brute. You don't have to come back as Rambo. You could come back and then become a beautiful, nurturing citizen, and then continue your lives. So she gave them that idea to take with them as they dispersed back home. Now, I left that ending out. It's such a wonderful ending, and you might wonder why I would leave it out. But the reason I left it out was that I was writing during feminist times when I didn't want to write about a woman who came back and put on makeup and a dress and shaved. And I didn't like that idea of her at all. And it makes me see how very much our times influence the myth that we receive and pass on. So now I feel is really the time for that ending where we are all returning home from so many wars, and how are we going to become that beautiful feminine spirit again? Let's see, another gift that I'm asking for is some money. Again, for this book, I would like to take a group of Vietnam veterans to France with me and go to a Vietnamese commune that's in Bordeaux. And it's a Vietnamese Buddhist commune. And I want to take my two brothers who are the last people that I wrote about in China Men, and I want to take Larry Heineman, who is coming here soon, I think, to speak. And he wrote Paco's story, and I think he's coming out soon with another book about war. And it's just maybe about six veterans, including a family of Chinese-American warriors that I know, that they served in the last three wars, and the father actually was a tactician who had sent his own son into a battle in Vietnam in which the entire platoon was killed except for his son. And this family, they just scare me, you know. I was having dinner with them, and the sons were all going on with their battle stories, and the mother of this family, the wife of one of them, said, "Oh, I knew you would all come back. Only the good die young." And so these are some of the people that I want to take on this journey to meet with the Vietnamese Buddhists and to meditate with them. And I want to write what happens and what happens when these people meet. Then, in case they do not enjoy meditating and eating vegetarian food, I want to also take them for a week in Paris. So I need enough money to do that. Okay, take about a dozen people, including the wives and girlfriends, because I think it's important to bring all the people that have supported these men and got them from were with them from the time they were warriors to the time that they are living as peaceful, productive citizens among us.
That was Maxine Hong Kingston speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland in 1992. Kingston is a contemporary Chinese-American author best known for her fiction and nonfiction writings about the experience of Chinese immigrants living in the United States. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear this or any other talks in the series, visit literary-arts.org. Spencer Raymond produces the Archive Project for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community, without whom this show would not be possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.